hidden under snow, bursting with electricity, ready to bite. It seems a wholly proportionate revenge. The next time Blonde Weed passes by with that bloody mutt of hers and the latter gets the idea of peeing on Uwe's paving, it'll do so onto an electrified, conductive metal plate. And then let's see how amusing they find it, Uwe thinks to himself. The cat tilts its head and looks at the metal sheet. Like a bolt of lightning up your urethra, says Uwe. The cat looks at him for a long time, as if to say, you're not serious, are you? Eventually, Uwe sticks his hands in his pockets and shakes his head. No. No, I suppose not, he sighs glumly. And then he packs up the battery and clamps and corrugated iron and puts everything in the garage. Not because he doesn't think those morons deserve a proper electric shock. Because they do. But because he knows it's been a while since someone reminded him of the difference between being wicked because one has to be, or because one can. It was a bloody good idea, though, he concludes to the cat as they go back into the house. The cat goes into the living room with the dismissive body language of someone mumbling, sure, sure, it was. And then they have lunch. Chapter 26. A man called Uwe and a society where no one can repair a bicycle anymore. Many people find it difficult living with someone who likes to be alone. It grates with those who can't handle it themselves. But Sonia didn't whine more than she had to. I took you as you were, she used to say. But Sonia was not so silly that she didn't understand that even men like Uwe like to have someone to talk to now and then. It had been quite a while since he'd had that. I won, Uwe says curtly when he hears the slamming of the postbox. The cat jumps off the window frame in the living room and goes into the kitchen. Bad loser, thinks Uwe, and goes to the front door. It's been years since he last made a bet with someone about what time the post would come. He used to make bets with Runa when they were on holiday in the summers, which grew so intensive that they developed complex systems of marginal extensions and half minutes to determine who was most accurate. That was how it was, back in those days. The post arrived at 12 o'clock on the dot, so one needed precise demarcations to be able to say who had guessed right. Nowadays it isn't like that. Nowadays the post can be delivered halfway through the afternoon, any old way it pleases. The post office takes care of it when it feels like it, and you just have to be grateful and that's it. Uwe tried to make bets with Sonia after he and Runa stopped talking, but she didn't understand the rules, so he gave up. The youth barely manages to avoid being knocked off the steps when Uwe throws the door open. Uwe looks at him in surprise. He's wearing a postman's uniform. Yes? Demands Uwe. The youth looks like he can't come up with an answer. He fiddles with a newspaper and a letter. And that's when Uwe notices that it's the same youth who argued with him about that bicycle a few days ago by the storage shed. The bicycle the youth said he was going to fix. Of course, Uwe knows what that means. Fix means steal and sell on the internet to these rascals. That's the long and short of it. The youth looks, if possible, even less thrilled about recognizing Uwe than vice versa. He looks a little like a waiter sometimes does, when he's undecided about whether to serve you your food or take it into the kitchen and spit on it. The lad looks coolly at Uwe before reluctantly handing the post over with a grumpy, there you go. Uwe accepts it without taking his eyes off him. Your letterbox is mashed, so I was going to give you these, says the youth. He nods at the folded double pile of junk that used to be Uwe's letterbox until the lanky one who can't reverse with a trailer reversed his trailer into it, then nods at the letter and newspaper in Uwe's hand. Uwe looks down at them. The newspaper is one of those local rags they hand out for nothing, even when one puts up a sign quite expressly telling them to do no such bloody thing, and the letter is most likely advertising, Uwe imagines. Admittedly, his name and address have been written in longhand on the front, but that's a typical advertising trick, to make one think it's a letter from a real person, and then one opens it, and in a flash, one has been subjected to marketing. That trick won't work on Uwe. The youth stands there, weighing on his heels and looking down at the ground, as if he's struggling with something inside that wants to come out. Was there something else? Uwe wonders. He pulls his hand through his greasy, late-pubescent shock of hair. What the hell? I was just wondering if you have a wife called Sonya, he manages to say. Uwe looks suspicious. The lad points at the envelope. I saw the surname. I had a teacher with that name. Was just wondering. He seems to be cursing himself for having said anything. He spins round on the spot and starts walking away. Uwe clears his throat and kicks the threshold. Wait. That could be right. What about Sonya? The lad stops a metre further away. Oh, shit. I just liked her. That's all I wanted to say. I'm not so good at reading and writing and all that. Uwe almost says, I'd never have guessed, but he leaves it. The youth twists awkwardly, runs his hand through his hair, somewhat disoriented, as if he's hoping to find the appropriate words up there somewhere. She's the only teacher I ever had who didn't think I was thick as a plank, he mumbles, almost choking on his emotion. She got me reading that Shakespeare, you know. I didn't know I could even read, sort of thing. She got me reading the most hardcore thick book and all. It felt really shit when I heard she died, you know. Uwe doesn't answer. The youth looks down at the ground, shrugs. That's it. He's silent. And then they both stand there, the 59-year-old and the teenager, a few metres apart, kicking at the snow, as if they were kicking a memory back and forth, a memory of a woman who insisted on seeing more potential in certain men than they saw in themselves. Neither of them know what to do with their shared experience. What are you doing with that bike? Says Uwe, at last. I promised to fix it up for my girlfriend. She lives there, the youth answers, nodding at the house at the far end of their row, opposite Anita and Runa's place, the one where those recycling types live when they're not in Thailand or wherever they go. Or, you know, she's not my girlfriend yet, but I'm thinking I'm wanting her to be, sort of thing. Uwe scrutinises the youth, as middle-aged men often scrutinise younger men who seem to invent their own grammar as they go along. So have you got any tools, then? He asks. The youth shakes his head. How are you going to repair a bike without tools? Uwe marvels, more with genuine surprise than agitation. The youth shrugs. Dunno. Why did you promise to repair it, then? The youth kicks the snow, scratches his face with his entire hand, embarrassed. Because I love her. Uwe can't quite decide what to say to that one. So he rolls up the local newspaper and envelope and slaps it into his palm like a baton. I have to get going, the youth mumbles almost inaudibly and makes a movement to turn round again. Come over after work, then, and I'll get the bike out for you. Uwe's words seem to pop up out of nowhere. But you have to bring your own tools, he adds. The youth brightens up. Are you serious, man? Uwe continues slapping the paper baton into his hand. The youth swallows. Awesome! Wait, shit, I can't pick it up today. I have to go to my other job. But tomorrow, man, I can come tomorrow. Is it cool if I pick it up tomorrow, like, instead? Uwe tilts his head and looks as if everything that's just been said came from the mouth of a character in an animated film. The youth takes a deep breath and pulls himself together. What other job? Asks Uwe, as if he's had an incomplete answer in the final of Jeopardy. I sort of work in a cafe in the evenings and at the weekends, says the youth, with that new one hope in his eyes about perhaps being able to rescue his fantasy relationship with a girlfriend who doesn't even know that she's his girlfriend, the sort of relationship that only a boy in late puberty with greasy hair can have. I need both jobs because I'm saving money, he explains. For what? A car. Uwe can't avoid noticing how he straightens up slightly when he says car. Uwe looks dubious for a moment, then he slowly but watchfully slaps the baton into his palm again. What sort of car? I had a look at a Renault, the youth says brightly, stretching a little more. The air around the two men stops for a hundredth of a breath or so. An eerie silence suddenly envelops them. If this was a scene from a film, the camera would very likely have time to pan 360 degrees around them before Uwe finally loses his composure. Renault.
Renault! That's bloody French! You can't bloody well go and buy a French car!
The youth seems just about to say something, but he doesn't get the chance before Uwe shakes his whole upper body as if trying to get rid of a persistent wasp.
Christ, you puppy! Don't you know anything about cars?
The youth shakes his head. Uwe sighs deeply and puts his hand on his forehead, as if he's been struck by a sudden migraine.
And how are you going to get the bicycle to the cafe if you don't have a car?
He says at long last, visibly struggling to regain his composure.
I haven't thought about that, says the youth.
Uwe shakes his head.
Renault, Christ almighty.
The youth nods. Uwe rubs his eyes in frustration.
Where's this sodding cafe you work at, then? He mutters.
20 minutes later, Pavana opens her front door in surprise. Uwe is standing outside, thoughtfully striking his hand with a paper baton.
Have you got one of those green signs?
What?
You have to have one of those green signs when you're a learner driver. Do you have one or not?
She nods.
Yeah, yes I have, but what? I'll come and pick you up in 2 hours. We'll take my car.
Uwe turns around and tramps back across the little road without waiting for an answer. Chapter 27 A Man Called Uwe and a Driving Lesson. It happened now and then in the almost 40 years they lived in the row of terraced houses that some thoughtless and recently moved-in neighbour was bold enough to ask Sonia what the real cause was for the deep animosity between Uwe and Runa. Why had two men, who had once been friends, suddenly started hating one another with such overpowering intensity? Sonia usually answered that it was quite straightforward. It was simply about how, when the two men and their wives moved into their houses, Uwe drove a Saab 96 and Runa a Volvo 244. A year or so later, Uwe bought a Saab 95 and Runa bought a Volvo 245. 3 years later, Uwe bought a Saab 900 and Runa bought a Volvo 265. In the decades that followed, Uwe bought another two Saab 900s and then a Saab 9000. Runa bought another Volvo 265 and then a Volvo 745, but a few years later he went back to a sedan model and acquired a Volvo 740, whereupon Uwe bought yet one more Saab 9000 and Runa eventually went over to a Volvo 760, after which Uwe got himself a Saab 9000i and Runa part exchanged to a Volvo 760 Turbo. And then the day came when Uwe went to the car dealer to look at the recently launched Saab 9-3, and when he came home in the evening, Runa had bought a BMW.
A BMW! Uwe had roared at Sonia. How can you reason with a human being like that? How?
And possibly it was not the entire explanation for why these two men loathed one another, Sonia used to explain. Either you understood it or you didn't. And if you didn't understand, there was no point even trying to clarify the rest. Those people never did understand, Uwe often commented. But then people had no idea of loyalty these days. The car was just a means of transport, and the road just a complication arising between two points. Uwe is convinced this is why the roads are as bad as they are. If people were a little more careful with their cars, they wouldn't drive like idiots, he thinks, watching with concern as Pavana pushes away the newspaper he has spread across her seat. She has to retract the driver's seat as far as it'll go, so she can manoeuvre her pregnant belly into the car, then bring it forward all the way so she can reach the wheel. The driving lesson doesn't start so well, or to be precise, it begins with Pavana trying to get into the Saab with a bottle of fizzy juice in her hand. She shouldn't have done that. Then she tries to fiddle with Uwe's radio to find a more entertaining channel. She shouldn't have done that either. Uwe picks up the newspaper from the floor, rolls it up and starts nervously striking it against his hand like a more aggressive version of a stress ball. She grabs the wheel and looks at the instruments like a curious child.
Where do we start?
She yells eagerly, after at long last agreeing to hand over the juice. Uwe sighs. The cat sits in the back seat and looks as if it wished with intensity that cats knew how to strap on safety belts.
Press the clutch pedal, says Uwe, slightly grim.
Havana looks around her seat as if searching for something. Then she looks at Uwe and smiles ingratiatingly.
Which one's the clutch?
Uwe's face fills with disbelief. She looks around the seat again, turns towards the seatbelt fixture in the backrest, as if she may find the clutch there. Uwe holds his forehead. Pavana's facial expression immediately sours.
I told you I want a driving license for an automatic. Why did you make me use your car?
Because you're getting a proper license. Uwe cuts her short, emphasizing proper in a way that makes it plain that a license for an automatic is as much a proper driving license as a car with an automatic gearbox is a proper car.
Stop shouting at me, shouts Pavana. I'm not shouting, Uwe shouts back.
The cat curls up in the back seat, clearly anxious not to end up in the middle of this, whatever it is. Pavana crosses her arms and glares out of the side window. Uwe strikes his paper baton rhythmically into the palm of his hand. The pedal on the far left is the clutch, he grunts in the end. After taking a breath so deep that he has to stop halfway for a rest before he inhales again, he continues. The one in the middle is the brake. On the far right is the accelerator. You release the clutch slowly until you find the point where it engages, then give it a bit of gas, release the clutch, and move off. Pavana seems to accept this as an apology. She nods and calms down, takes hold of the steering wheel, starts the car, and follows his instructions. The Saab lurches forward with a little jump, then pauses before catapulting itself with a loud roar towards the guest parking and very nearly crashing into another car. Uwe tugs at the handbrake. Pavana lets go of the steering wheel and yells in panic, covering her eyes with her hands until the Saab finally comes to an abrupt stop. Uwe is puffing, as if he had to make his way to the handbrake by forcing himself through a military obstacle course. His facial muscles twitch like a man whose eyes are being sprayed with lemon juice.
What do I do now?
Roars Pavana when she realizes that the Saab is 2 centimeters from the tail lights of the car in front.
Reverse. You put it in reverse, Uwe manages to say through his teeth.
I almost smashed into that car, pants Pavana.
Uwe peers over the edge of the bonnet, and then suddenly a sort of calm comes over his face. He turns and nods at her, very matter-of-fact.
Doesn't matter, it's a Volvo.
It takes them 15 minutes to get out of the parking area and onto the main road. Once they're there, Pavana revs the first gear until the Saab vibrates like it's about to explode. Uwe tells her to change gear, and she replies that she doesn't know how. Meanwhile, the cat seems to be trying to open the back door. When they get to the first red light, a big black city jeep, with 2 shaven-headed young men in the front, pulls up so close to their rear bumper that Uwe is pretty sure he'll have their registration number etched into his paintwork when they get home. Pavana glances nervously in the mirror. The city jeep revs its engine, as if giving vent to some sort of opinion. Uwe turns round and looks out of the back window. The 2 men have tattoos all over their throats, he notes, as if the city jeep is not a clear enough advertisement for their stupidity. The light turns green. Pavana brings up the clutch. The Saab splutters and the instrument panel goes black. Stressed, Pavana turns the key in the ignition, which only makes it grind in a heart-rending manner. The engine makes a roar, coughs, and dies anew. The men with the shaved heads and tattooed throats sound the horn. One of them gestures.
Press down the clutch and give it more gas, says Uwe.
That's what I'm doing, she answers.
That's not what you're doing.
Yes, I am.
Now you're shouting.
I'm not bloody shouting, she shouts.
The city jeep blares its horn. Pavana presses down the clutch. The Saab rolls backwards a few centimetres and bumps into the front of the city jeep. The throat tattoos are now hanging on the horn as if it's an air raid alarm. Pavana tugs despairingly at the key, only to be rewarded by yet another stall. Then suddenly, she lets go of everything and hides her face in her hands.
Good God, are you crying now?
Uwe asks in amazement.
I'm not bloody crying,
she howls, her tears spattering over the dashboard. Uwe leans back and looks down at his knee, fingers the end of the paper baton.
It's just such a strain, this. Do you understand?
She sobs and leans her forehead against the wheel as if hoping it might be soft and fluffy.
I'm sort of pregnant. I'm just a bit stressed. Can no one show a bit of understanding for a pregnant bloody woman who's a bit stressed?
Uwe twists uncomfortably in the passenger seat. She punches the steering wheel several times, mumbles something about how all she wants is to drink some bloody lemonade, flops her arms over the top of the steering wheel, buries her face in her sleeves and starts crying again. The city jeep behind them signals until it sounds as if the Finland ferry is about to run them down. And then, something in Uwe snaps. He throws the door open, gets out of the car, walks slowly round the city jeep and rips the driver's door open.
Have you never been a learner driver, or what?
The driver doesn't have time to answer.
You stupid little bastard!
Uwe roars in the face of the shaven-headed young man with throat tattoos, his spittle cascading over their seats. The throat tattoo doesn't have time to answer, and Uwe doesn't wait for him either. Instead, he grabs the young man by his collar and pulls him up so hard that his body tumbles clumsily out of the car. He's a muscular sort, easily weighing in at 100 kilos, but Uwe holds his collar in an immovable steel grip. Evidently, Throat Tattoo is so surprised by the strength in the old man's grip that it doesn't occur to him to put up any resistance. Fury burns in Uwe's eyes as he presses the probably 35 years younger man so hard against the side of the city jeep that the bodywork creaks. He places the tip of his index finger in the middle of the shaved head and positions his eyes so close to Throat Tattoo's face that they feel each other's breath. If you sound that horn one more time, it'll be the last thing you do on this earth. Got it? Throat Tattoo allows his eyes to divert quickly towards his equally muscular friend inside the car, and then at the growing queue of other cars behind the city jeep. No one is making the slightest move to come to his assistance. No one beeps. No one moves. Everyone seems to be thinking the same thing. If a non-throat-tattooed man of Uwe's age, without any hesitation, steps up to a throat-tattooed man of the age of this throat tattoo and presses him up against a car in this manner, then it's very likely not the throat-tattooed man one should be most worried about annoying. Uwe's eyes are black with anger. After a short moment of reflection, Throat Tattoo seems convinced by the argument that the old man unmistakably means business. The tip of his nose, almost unnoticeably, moves up and down. Uwe nods by way of confirmation and lets him back down on the ground, then turns round, walks around the city jeep, and gets back into the Saab. Pavana stares at him, with her mouth hanging open. "Now, you listen to me," says Uwe calmly while he carefully closes the door. "You've given birth to 2 children, and quite soon you'll be squeezing out a third. You've come here from a land far away, and most likely you've fled war and persecution and all sorts of other nonsense. You've learned a new language and got yourself an education, and you're holding together a family of obvious incompetence. And I'll be damned if I've seen you afraid of a single bloody thing in this world before now." Uwe rivets his eyes into her. Pavana is still agape. Uwe points imperiously at the pedals under her feet. "I'm not asking for brain surgery. I'm asking you to drive a car. It's got an accelerator, a brake, and a clutch. Some of the greatest twits in world history have sorted out how it works, and you will as well." And then he utters 7 words, which Pavana will always remember as the loveliest compliment he'll ever give her. "Because you are not a complete twit." Pavana pushes a ringlet of hair out of her face, sticky with tears. Clumsily, she once again grabs hold of the steering wheel with both hands. Uwe nods, puts on his safety belt, and makes himself comfortable. "Now, push the clutch down and do what I say." And that afternoon, Pavana learns to drive. Chapter 28. A man who was Uwe and a man who was Runa. Sonia used to say that Uwe was unforgiving. For instance, he refused to go back to the local bakery 8 years after they gave him the wrong change when he bought pastries once at the end of the 1990s. Uwe called it having firm principles. They were never quite in agreement when it came to words and their meanings. He knows that she is disappointed that he and Runa could not keep the peace. He knows that the animosity between him and Runa to some extent ruined the possibility of Sonia and Anita becoming the great friends they could have been. But when a conflict has been going on for long enough, it can be impossible to sort out, for the simple reason that no one can remember how it first started. And Uwe didn't know how it first started. He only knew how it ended. A BMW. There must have been some people who understood it and some who didn't. There were probably people who thought there was no connection between cars and emotions. But there would never be a clearer explanation as to why these two men had become enemies for life. Of course it had started innocently enough, not long after Uwe and Sonia came back from Spain and the accident. Uwe laid new paving stones in their little garden that summer, whereupon Runa put up a new fence round his. Whereupon Uwe put up an even higher fence round his garden, whereupon Runa went off to the builders' merchants, and a few days later started boasting all over the street that he had built a swimming pool. "That was no bloody swimming pool," Uwe raged to Sonia. "It was a little splash pool for Runa and Anita's newborn urchin. That was all it was." For a while, Uwe had plans to report it to the planning department as an illegal construction. But at that point, Sonia put her foot down and sent him out to mow the lawn and calm himself down. And so Uwe did just that, although it certainly did not calm him down very much at all. The lawn was oblong, about 5 meters wide, and ran along the back of Uwe and Runa's houses, and the house in between, which Sonia and Anita had quickly named the Neutral Zone. No one quite knew what that lawn was for or what function it was expected to fill. But when terraced housing was put up in those days, some city architect must have got the idea that there had to be lawns here and there for no other reason than that they looked so very nice in the drawings. When Uwe and Runa formed the Residents' Association and were still friends, the two men decided that Uwe should be the groundsman and responsible for keeping the grass mowed. It had always been Uwe before. On one occasion, the other neighbours had proposed that the association should put out tables and benches on the lawn to create a sort of common space for all the neighbours. But obviously Uwe and Runa put a stop to that at once. It would only turn into a bloody mess and lots of noise. And as far as that went, it was all peace and joy, at least insofar as anything could be peace and joy when men like Uwe and Runa were involved. Soon after Runa had built his pool, a rat ran across Uwe's newly mown lawn and into the trees on the other side. Uwe immediately called a crisis meeting of the association and demanded that all local residents put out rat poison around their houses. The neighbours protested, of course, because they had seen hedgehogs by the edge of the woods and were concerned that they might eat the poison. Runa also protested because he was afraid that some of it would end up in his pool. Uwe suggested to Runa that he button up his shirt and go see a psychologist about his delusions of living on the French Riviera. Runa made a malicious joke at Uwe's expense, to the effect that Uwe had probably only imagined seeing that rat. All the others laughed. Uwe never forgave Runa for that. The next morning, someone had thrown birdseed all over Runa's outside space, and Runa had to use a spade to chase away a dozen rats as big as vacuum cleaners in the next few weeks. After that, Uwe got permission to put out poison, even though Runa mumbled that he'd pay him back for this. 2 years later, Runa won the Great Tree Conflict when he gained permission at the annual meeting to saw down a tree blocking his and Anita's evening sun on one side. The same tree on the other side screened off Uwe and Sonia's bedroom from blinding morning sunlight. Further, he managed to block Uwe's furious motion that the association would then have to pay for Uwe's new awning. However, Uwe got his revenge during the snow-clearance skirmish of the following winter, in which Runa wanted to anoint himself chief of snow-shoveling, and at the same time lumber the residents' association with the purchase of a gigantic snow-slinger. Uwe had no intention of letting Runa walk round with some bloody contraption at the expense of the association and spray snow over Uwe's windows, which he made crystal clear at the steering group meeting. Runa was still chosen to be responsible for snow clearance, but to his great annoyance, he had to spend all winter shovelling the snow by hand between the houses. The outcome of this, of course, was that he consistently shovelled outside all the houses in their row, except Uwe and Sonia's. Just to annoy Runa, in mid-January, Uwe hired a gigantic snowslinger to clear the 10 square meters outside his door. Runa was incandescent about it, Uwe remembers with delight to this day. Of course, Runa found a way of paying him back the following summer by buying one of those monstrous lawn tractors. Then, by a combination of treachery, lies, and conspiracies, he managed to get approval at the annual meeting to take over Uwe's lawn-mowing responsibilities on the grounds that he had slightly more adequate equipment than the one who was in charge of it before. As a partial restitution, Uwe managed, some 4 years later, to stop Runa's plans of putting in new windows in his house, because after 33 letters and a dozen angry telephone calls, the planning department gave up and accepted Uwe's argument that this would ruin the harmonized architectural character of the area. In the following 3 years, Runa refused to speak of Uwe as anything but that bloody red tapist. Uwe took it as a compliment, and the next year he changed his own windows. When the next winter set in, the steering group decided that the area needed a new collective heating system. Quite coincidentally, of course, Runa and Uwe happened to have diametrically different views on what sort of heating system was required, which was jokingly referred to by the other neighbours as the Battle of the Water Pump. It grew into an eternal struggle between the two men. And so it continued. But as Sonia used to say, there were also some other moments. There weren't many of them, but women like Sonia and Anita knew how to make the most of them, because there hadn't always been burning conflict. One summer in the 1980s, for instance, Uwe had bought a Saab 9000 and Runa a Volvo 760. And they were so pleased with this that they kept the peace for several weeks. Sonia and Anita even managed to get all four of them together for dinner on a few occasions. Runa and Anita's son, who'd had time to turn into a teenager by this stage, with all the divinely sanctioned charmlessness and impoliteness this entailed, sat at one end of the table, like an irritable accessory. "That boy was born angry," Sonia used to say with sadness in her voice. But Uwe and Runa managed to get along so well that they even had a little whiskey together at the end of the evening. Unfortunately, at their last dinner that summer, Uwe and Runa had the idea of having a barbecue. And obviously they started feuding at once about the most effective way of lighting Uwe's globe grill. Within 15 minutes the argument had escalated so much in volume that Sonia and Anita agreed it might be best to eat their dinner separately after all. The two men had time to buy and sell a Volvo 760 Turbo and a Saab 9000i before they spoke to one another again. Meanwhile, the neighbours came and went in the row of houses. In the end, there had been so many new faces in the doorways of the other terraced houses that they all merged in a sea of grey. Where before there had been forest, there were only construction cranes. Uwe and Runa stood outside their houses, hands obstinately shoved into their trouser pockets, like ancient relics in a new age, while a parade of uppity estate agents barely able to see over their grapefruit-sized tie knots patrolled the little road between the houses and kept their eyes on them, like vultures watching aging water buffaloes. They could hardly wait to move some bloody consultants' families into their houses. Both Uwe and Runa knew that very well. Runa and Anita's son moved away from home when he was 20, in the early 1990s. Apparently he went to America, Uwe found out from Sonia. They hardly saw him again. From time to time, Anita had a telephone call, around the time of Christmas, but he was so busy with his own things now, as Anita said when she tried to keep her spirits up, even though Sonia could see that she had to hold back her tears. Some boys leave everything behind and never look back. That was all there was to it. Runa never said anything about it, but to anyone who had known him a long time, it was as if he grew a few centimetres shorter in the years that followed, as if he sort of crumpled with a deep sigh and never really breathed properly again. A few years later, Runa and Uwe fell out for the 100th time about that collective heating system. Uwe stormed out of a residents' association meeting in a fury and never returned. The last battle the two men fought was a bit into the noughties when Runa bought one of those automated robotic lawn mowers which he'd ordered from Asia and left it to whiz about on the lawn behind the houses. Runa could even remotely program it to cut special patterns, Sonia said in an impressed tone of voice one evening when she came home from visiting Anita. Uwe soon twigged that this special pattern was the habit of that robotic little shit to consistently rumble back and forth all night outside Uwe and Sonia's bedroom window. One evening Sonia saw Uwe fetch a screwdriver and walk out of the veranda door. Next morning the little robot, quite inexplicably, had driven right into Runa's pool. The month after, Runa went into the hospital for the first time. He never bought another lawnmower. Uwe did not know himself how their animosity had begun, though he knew very well that it ended there and then. Afterwards it was only memories for Uwe, and a lack of them for Runa. And there were very likely people who thought one could not interpret men's feelings by the cars they drove. But when they moved into the terrace, Uwe drove a Saab 96 and Runa a Volvo 244. After the accident, Uwe bought a Saab 95 so he'd have space for Sonia's wheelchair. That same year, Runa bought a Volvo 245 to have space for a pram. 3 years later, Sonia got a more modern wheelchair and Uwe bought a hatchback, a Saab 900. Runa bought a Volvo 265 because Anita had started talking about having another child. Then Uwe bought two more Saab 900s, and after that his first Saab 9000. Runa bought a Volvo 265, and eventually a Volvo 745 estate. But no more children came. One evening Sonia came home and told Uwe that Anita had been to the doctor. And a week later, a Volvo 740 stood parked in Runa's garage, the saloon model. Uwe saw it when he washed his Saab. In the evening, Runa found a half bottle of whiskey outside his door. They never spoke about it. Maybe their sorrow over children that never came should have brought the two men closer. But sorrow is unreliable in that way. When people don't share it, there's a good chance that it will drive them apart instead. Maybe Uwe never forgave Runa for having a son that he could not even get along with. Maybe Runa never forgave Uwe for not being able to forgive him for it. Maybe neither of them forgave themselves for not being able to give the women they loved more than anything what they wanted more than anything. Runa and Anita's lad grew up and cleared out of home as soon as he got the chance. And Runa went and bought a sporty BMW, one of those cars that only has space for two people and a handbag. Because now it was only him and Anita, as he told Sonia when they met in the parking area.
"And one can't drive a Volvo all one's life," he said with an attempt at a half-hearted smile.
She could hear that he was trying to swallow his tears. And that was the moment when Uwe realized that a part of Runa had given up forever. And for that, maybe neither Uwe nor Runa forgave him. So, there were certainly people who thought that feelings could not be judged by looking at cars. But they were wrong. Chapter 29. A Man Called Uwe and a Bender.
"Seriously, where are we going?" Bhavana wonders, out of breath.
"To fix something," Uwe answers curtly, three steps ahead of her, with the cat half jogging at his side.
"What thing?"
"A thing." Bhavana stops and catches her breath.
"Here,"
Uwe calls out, and stops abruptly in front of a little cafe. A scent of fresh-baked croissant comes through the glass door. Bhavana looks at the parking area on the other side of the street where they left the Saab. In the end, they could not have parked closer to the cafe. At first, Uwe had been absolutely convinced that the cafe was at the other end of the block. That was when Bhavana had suggested they could possibly park on that side, but the notion was abandoned once they found that parking cost 1 crown more per hour. Instead, they had parked here and walked all around the block looking for the cafe, because Uwe, as Bhavana had soon realized, was the sort of man who, when he was not quite certain where he was going, just carried on walking straight ahead, convinced that the road would eventually fall into line. And now, when they find that the cafe is directly opposite the spot where they parked, Uwe looks as if this was his plan all along. Bhavana mops some sweat off her cheek. A man with a ragged, dirty beard is leaning against a wall halfway down the street. He has a paper cup in front of him. Outside the cafe, Uwe, Pavana, and the cat meet a slim boy, aged about 20, who has what looks very much like black soot around his eyes. It takes Uwe a moment to realize it's the boy who was standing behind the lad with the bicycle when Uwe met him the first time. He looks a little cautious, although he smiles at Uwe. Uwe can't think of anything to do but nod back, as if wanting to clarify that while he has no intention of returning the smile, he is prepared to acknowledge receipt of it. "Why didn't you let me park next to the red car?" Pavana wants to know as they open the glass door and step inside. Uwe doesn't answer. "I would have managed it," she says, self-confidently. Uwe shakes his head wearily. 2 hours ago she didn't know where the clutch was. Now she's irritated because he won't let her squeeze into a narrow parking space. Once they're inside the cafe, Uwe sees in the corner of his eye how the slim, soot-eyed boy offers the sandwiches to the vagrant. "Hi there, Uwe!" a voice calls out so eagerly that it cracks into falsetto in the high notes. Uwe turns round and sees the lad from the bike shed. He's standing behind a long, polished counter at the front of the premises, wearing a baseball cap, Uwe notes. Indoors. The cat and Pavana make themselves at home, the latter mopping sweat from her forehead, although it's ice cold in there. Colder than outside in the street, actually. She pours herself some water from a jug on the counter. The cat unconcernedly laps up some of it from her glass when she isn't looking.
"Do you know each other?" Pavana asks with surprise, looking at the youth.
"Me and Uwe are sort of mates," the youth nods.
"Are you? Me and Uwe are sort of mates too," Pavana grins, tenderly imitating his enthusiasm.
Uwe stops at a safe distance from the counter, as if someone might give him a hug if he gets too close.
"My name's Adrian," says the youth.
"Pavana," says Pavana.
"You want something to drink?"
he asks them.
"A latte for me, please," says Pavana, in a tone of voice as if she's suddenly having her shoulders massaged. She dabs her forehead with a napkin. "Preferably an iced latte, if you have it."
Uwe shifts his weight from his left foot to his right and peers round the premises. He's never liked cafes. Sonia, of course, loved them, could sit in them for an entire Sunday, just looking at people, as she put it. Uwe used to try and sit there with her, reading a newspaper. Every Sunday they did it. He hasn't put his foot in a cafe since she died. He looks up and realizes that Adrian, Pavana and the cat are waiting for his answer.
"Coffee, then. Black."
Adrian scratches his hair under the cap.
"So, espresso?"
"Nope. Coffee."
Adrian transfers his scratching from hair to chin.
"What, like black coffee?"
"Yes.
With milk?"
"If it's with milk, it's not black coffee."
Adrian moves a couple of sugar bowls on the counter, mainly to have something to do so he doesn't look too silly. A bit late for that, thinks Uwe.
"Normal filter coffee. Normal bloody filter coffee," Uwe repeats.
Adrian nods.
"Oh, that. Oh, well, I don't know how to make it."
Uwe points aggressively at the percolator in the corner, only barely visible behind a gigantic silver spaceship of a machine, which, Uwe understands, is what they use for making espresso.
"Oh, that one, yeah," says Adrian, as if the penny has just dropped.
"Ha ha, I don't really know how that thing works."
"Should have bloody known,"
mutters Uwe, as he walks round the counter and takes matters into his own hands.
"Can someone tell me what we're doing here?" calls Pavana.
"This lad here has a bicycle that needs repairing," explains Uwe, as he pours water into the jug.
"The bicycle? Hanging off the back of the car?" "You brought it here. Thanks, Uwe."
"You don't have a car, do you?"
he replies, while rummaging around a cupboard for coffee filters.
"Thanks, Uwe," says Adrian, and takes a step towards him,
then comes to his senses and stops before he does something silly.
"So that's your bicycle," Pavana smiles.
"Kind of. It's my girlfriend's, or the one I want to be my girlfriend, sort of thing."
Pavana grins.
"So me and Uwe drove all this way just to give you a bike so you can mend it for a girl."
Adrian nods. Pavana leans over the counter and pats Uwe on the arm. You know, Uwe, sometimes one almost suspects you have a heart.
Do you have tools here or not? Uwe says to Adrian, snatching his arm away.
Adrian nods.
Go and get them, then. The bike's on the Saab in the car park.
Adrian nods quickly and disappears into the kitchen. After a minute or so, he comes back with a big toolbox, which he quickly takes to the exit.
And you?
Be quiet, Uwe says to Pavana. She smirks in a way that suggests she has no intention of keeping quiet.
I only brought the bicycle here so he wouldn't mess about in the sheds back home, Uwe adds.
Sure, sure, says Pavana with a laugh.
Oh, hey, says Adrian, as the soot-eyed boy appears again a moment later.
This is my boss.
Hi there. What are you doing?
Asks the boss, looking with some interest at the spry stranger who has barricaded himself behind the counter of his cafe.
The kid's going to fix a bicycle, answers Uwe, as if this was something plain and obvious. Where do you keep the filters for real coffee?
The soot-eyed boy points at one of the shelves. Uwe squints at him.
Is that makeup?
Pavana hushes him up. Uwe looks insulted.
What? What's wrong with asking?
The boy smiles a little nervously.
Yeah, it's makeup,
he nods, rubbing himself around his eyes.
I went dancing last night,
he says, smiling gratefully as Pavana, with the deftness of a fellow conspirator, hauls out a wet wipe from her handbag and offers it to him. Uwe nods and goes back to his coffee making.
And do you also have problems with bicycles and love and girls?
He asks, absent-mindedly.
No, no, not with bicycles anyway, and not with love either, I suppose. Well, not with girls anyway,
he chuckles. Uwe turns on the percolator, and once it begins to splutter, turns round and leans against the inside of the counter, as if this is the most natural thing in the world in a cafe where one doesn't work.
Bent, are you?
Uwe, says Pavana, and slaps him on the arm.
Uwe snatches back his arm and looks very offended.
What? You don't say, you don't call it that,
Pavana says, clearly unwilling to spell out the word again.
Queer,
Uwe offers. Pavana tries to hit his arm again, but Uwe is too quick.
Don't talk like that, she orders him.
Uwe turns to the sooty boy, genuinely puzzled.
Can't one say bent? What are you supposed to say nowadays?
You say homosexual or an LGBT person. Pavana interrupts before she has time to stop herself.
You say what you want is cool,
the boy smiles as he walks round the counter and puts on an apron.
Right, good, good to be clear. One of those gays, then, mumbles Uwe.
Pavana shakes her head apologetically. The boy just laughs.
Well then,
says Uwe with a nod and starts pouring himself a coffee while it's still going through. Then he takes the cup and without another word goes outside into the parking area. The sooty boy doesn't comment on his taking the cup outside. It would seem a little unnecessary, under the circumstances, when this man, within 5 minutes of his arrival at the boy's cafe, has already appointed himself as barista and interrogated him about his sexual preferences. Adrian is standing outside by the Saab, looking as if he just got lost in a forest.
Is it going well?
Asks Uwe, rhetorically taking a sip of coffee and looking at the bicycle, which Adrian hasn't even unhooked yet from the back of the car.
Nah, you know, sort of, well,
Adrian begins compulsively scratching his chest. Uwe observes him for half a minute or so, takes another mouthful of his coffee, nods irritably like someone squeezing an avocado and finding it overly ripe. He forcefully presses his cup of coffee into the hands of the boy and then steps forward to unhitch the bicycle, turns it upside down, and opens the toolbox which the youth has brought from the cafe.
Didn't your dad ever teach you how to fix a bike?
He says, without looking at Adrian, while he hunches over the punctured tyre.
My dad's banged up,
Adrian replies almost inaudibly, and scratches his shoulder, looking round as if he'd like to find a big black hole to sink into. Uwe stops himself, looks up, and gives him an evaluating stare. The boy stares at the ground. Uwe clears his throat.
It's not so bloody difficult, he mutters at long last and gestures at Adrian to sit on the ground.
It takes them 10 minutes to repair the puncture. Uwe barks monosyllabic instructions, Adrian remains silent throughout. But he's attentive and dexterous and in a certain sense does not make a complete fool of himself, Uwe has to admit. Maybe he's not quite as fumbling with his hands as he is with words. They wipe off the dirt with a rag from the boot of the Saab, avoiding eye contact with each other. "I hope the lady's worth it," says Uwe, and closes the boot. Now it's Adrian's turn to look nonplussed. When they go back into the cafe, there's a short, cube-shaped man in a stained shirt standing on a stepladder, tinkering with something that Uwe suspects is a fan heater. The sooty boy stands below the stepladder with a selection of screwdrivers held aloft. He keeps mopping the remnants of makeup around his eyes, peering at the fat man on the ladder and looking a little on the nervous side, as if worried that he may be caught out. Pavana turns excitedly to Uwe.
"This is Amo. He owns the cafe," she says in a suitably gushing manner.
She points to the cubic man on the ladder. Amel doesn't turn round, but he emits a long sequence of hard consonants that, even though Uwe does not understand them, he suspects to be various combinations of four-letter words and body parts.
"What's he saying?" asks Adrian.
The sooty boy twists uncomfortably.
Something about the fan eater being a bit of a fairy."
He looks over at Adrian, then quickly turns his face down.
"What's that?" asks Uwe, wandering over to him.
"He means it's worthless like a homo," he says in such a low voice that only Uwe catches his words. Pavana, on the other hand, is busy pointing at Amel with delight.
"You can't hear what he's saying, but you sort of know that almost all of it is swear words. He's like a dubbed version of you, Uwe."
Uwe doesn't look particularly delighted, nor does Amel. He stops tinkering with the fan heater and points at Uwe with the screwdriver.
"The cat. Is that your cat?"
"No," says Uwe. Not so much because he wants to point out that it isn't his cat, but because he wants to clarify that it's no one's cat.
"Cat out. No animals in cafe."
Amel slashes at the consonants so that they hop about like naughty children caught inside the sentence. Uwe looks with interest at the fan heater above Amel's head, then at the cat on the bar stool, then at the toolbox, which Adrian is still holding in his hand, then at the fan heater again, and at Amel.
"If I repair that for you, the cat stays."
He offers this more as a statement than a question. Amel seems to lose his self-possession for a few moments. By the time he regains it, in a way he could probably not explain afterwards, he has become the man holding the stepladder rather than the man standing on the stepladder. Uwe digs about up there for a few minutes, climbs down, brushes the palm of his hand against his trouser leg, and hands the screwdriver and a little adjustable spanner to the sooty boy.
"You're fixed!"
cries Amel suddenly as the fan heater splutters back to life. In an effusive manner, he grabs Uwe's shoulders.
"Whiskey! You want? In my kitchen I have the whiskey!"
Uwe checks his watch. It's 2:15 in the afternoon. He shakes his head whilst looking a little uncomfortable, partly about the whiskey and partly because of Amel, who is still holding on to him. The sooty boy disappears through the kitchen door, behind the counter, still frenetically rubbing his eyes. Adrian catches up with Uwe and the cat on their way back to the Saab.
"Uwe, mate, you won't say anything about Mursad being..."
"My boss," says Adrian, "the one with the makeup."
"The bent person," says Uwe.
Adrian nods.
Amel, he doesn't know Mersad is..."
Adrian fumbles for the right word.
"A bender,"
Uwe adds. Adrian nods. Uwe shrugs. Pavana comes wagging along behind them, out of breath.
"Where did you get to?" Uwe asks her.
"I gave my change to him,"
says Pavana with a nod at the man with the dirty beard by the house wall.
"You know he'll only spend it on schnapps," Uwe states.
Pavana opens her eyes wide with something Uwe strongly suspects to be sarcasm.
"Really, will he? And I was so hoping he would use it to pay off his student loans from his university education in particle physics."
Uwe snorts and opens the Saab. Adrian stays where he is on the other side of the car.
"Yes?"
Uwe wonders.
"You won't say anything about Mursad, will you? Seriously?"
"Why the hell would I say anything?"
Uwe points at him with exasperation.
You want to buy a French car. Don't worry so much about others. You have enough problems of your own.
Chapter 30. A Man Called Uwe and a Society Without Him. Uwe brushes the snow off the gravestone, digs determinedly into the frozen ground and carefully replenishes the flowers. He stands up, dusts himself off, and looks helplessly at her name, feeling ashamed of himself. He, who always used to nag at her about being late. Now he stands here himself, apparently quite incapable of following her as he planned. "It's just been bloody mayhem," he mumbles to the stone. And then he's silent again. He doesn't know what happened to him after her funeral. The days and weeks floated together in such a way, and in such utter silence, that he could hardly describe what exactly he was doing. Before Pavana and that Patrick reversed into his postbox, he could barely remember saying a word to another human being since Sonia died. Some evenings he forgets to eat. That's never happened before, as far as he can remember. Not since he sat down with her on that train almost 40 years ago. As long as Sonia was there, they had their routines. Uwe got up at 5:45, made coffee, went off for his inspection. By 6:30, Sonia had showered, and then they had breakfast and drank coffee. Sonia had eggs. Uwe had bread. At 7:05, Uwe carried her into the passenger seat of the Saab, stowed her wheelchair in the boot, and gave her a lift to school. Then he drove to work. At 9:45, they took coffee breaks separately. Sonia took milk in her coffee. Uwe had it black. At 12, they had lunch. At 3:15, another coffee break. At 5:15, Uwe picked up Sonia in the school forecourt, hoisted her into the passenger seat and the wheelchair into the boot. By 6:00, they were at the kitchen table having their dinner, usually meat and potatoes and sauce, Uwe's favourite meal. Then she solved crosswords with her legs drawn up beneath her on the sofa, while Uwe pottered about in the tool shed and watched the news. At 9:30, Uwe carried her upstairs to the bedroom. She nagged him for years about moving into the empty downstairs guest room, but Uwe refused. After a decade or so, she realized that this was his way of showing her that he had no intention of giving up, that God and the universe and all the other things would not be allowed to win, that the swine could go to hell. So she stopped nagging. On Friday nights, they sat up until 10:30 watching television. On Saturdays, they had a late breakfast, sometimes as late as 8. Then they went out to do their errands, the builder's merchant, furniture shop, and garden centre. Sonia would buy potting soil, and Uwe liked to look at tools. They only had a small terraced house with a tiny outside space, yet there always seemed to be something to plant and something to build. On the way home, they'd stop for ice cream. Sonia would have one with chocolate, and Uwe one with nuts. Once a year, they raised the price by 1 crown per ice cream, and then, as Sonia put it, Uwe would have a tantrum. When they got back to the house, she'd roll out of the little terrace door onto the patio, and Uwe would help her out of the chair and gently put her on the ground so she could do some gardening in her beloved flower beds. In the meantime, Uwe would fetch a screwdriver and disappear into the house. That was the best thing about the house. It was never finished. There was always a screw somewhere for Uwe to tighten. On Sundays they went to a cafe and drank coffee. Uwe read the newspaper, and Sonia talked. And then it was Monday. And one Monday she was no longer there. And Uwe didn't know exactly when he became so quiet. He'd always been taciturn, but this was something quite different. Maybe he had started talking more inside his own head. Maybe he was going insane. He did wonder sometimes. It was as if he didn't want other people to talk to him. He was afraid that their chattering voices would drown out the memory of her voice. He lets his fingers run gently across the gravestone, as if running them through the long tassels of a very thick rug. He's never understood young people who bang on about finding themselves. He used to hear that non-stop from all those 30-year-olds at work. All they ever talked about was how they wanted more leisure time, as if that was the only point of working, to get to the point when one didn't have to do it. Sonia used to laugh at Uwe and call him the most inflexible man in the world. Uwe refused to take that as an insult. He thought there should be some order in things. There should be routines, and one should be able to feel secure about them. He could not see how it could be a bad attribute. Sonia used to tell people about the time that Uwe, in a moment of temporary mental dislocation in the middle of the 1980s, had been persuaded by her to get himself a red Saab, even though in all the years she'd known him, he'd always driven a blue one. "They were the worst 3 years of Uwe's life," Sonia tittered. Since then, Uwe had never driven anything but a blue Saab. Other wives get annoyed because their husbands don't notice when they have their hair cut. "When I have a haircut, my husband is annoyed with me for days because I don't look the same," Sonia used to say. That's what Uwe misses most of all, having things the same as usual. People need a function, he believes, and he has always been functional. No one can take that away from him. It was 13 years since Uwe bought his blue Saab 9-5 estate. Not long after, the Yanks at General Motors bought up the last Swedish-held shares in the company. Uwe closed the newspaper that morning with a long string of swear words that continued into a good part of the afternoon. He never bought a car again. He had no intention of placing his foot in an American car, unless his foot and the rest of his body had first been placed in a coffin. They should be bloody clear about that. Sonia had, of course, also read the article, and she had certain objections to Uwe's exact version of events regarding the company's nationality, but it made no difference.